It's time now for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings at this time, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger, editor and publisher of the Timberjay, a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Good morning, Marshall. Thanks for being back.
Well, happy to be here, Heidi.
Big news when it comes to copper nickel mining. The PolyMet project came out this week. Help us understand it.
Well, it's kind of hard to understand in a way. Both sides seem to be very pleased, or at least are stating publicly that they're very pleased with the outcome here. Perhaps that's because this was kind of a mixed verdict by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and this was on a case that had come up from the Court of Appeals, which had sided largely with environmental groups and had suspended a number of key permits for the project. So both PolyMet and the Department of Natural Resources, which had issued those permits, and which included the permit to mine, they had appealed this to the Supreme Court. And they made some progress, it seems like, with the Supreme Court. The court did reverse the Court of Appeals on a number of issues. The Court of Appeals back in January of 2020 had ordered a contested case hearing on disputes over the method of tailings dam construction, financial assurance, and the role of PolyMet's majority owner, Glencore, in the permitting process. And the High Court found that the Department of Natural Resources had acted largely within its discretion when it denied a request by a number of environmental groups, including Water Legacy and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, as well as the Fond du Lac Band, for contested case hearings to present evidence contrary to the DNR's position on those permits. Now, that means that the DNR won't have to have a contested case hearing on those issues. So based on that, you know, PolyMet's CEO, John Cherry, declared this a big victory. At the same time, however, the Supreme Court did agree with the Court of Appeals that the DNR had erred by not placing a time limit on PolyMet's permit to mine. Apparently, under state law, there needs to be a limit on that, or, you know, at some point it has to be a term, 50 years, 20 years, whatever it is. And they did not do that with PolyMet's permit. And so they're going to have to go back and figure out a term. And it sounds like it could be a relatively simple thing, but it may be a lot more complicated than it might sound. And there were some major issues that had sort of been fudged in a way in that by not including a term. So it's going to be interesting to see how they'll be able to address those issues if they do have to establish a term. At the same time, they also agreed, Supreme Court agreed with the lower court, that PolyMet and the DNR do need to have a contested case hearing on their use of a type of clay known as bentonite, which they had proposed to use as sort of a cap on their tailings basin and, you know, to kind of keep oxygen out of waste rock that will be generated by this mine. And the High Court did agree that that proposal was not backed by science, which is something that the Court of Appeals had found as well. And they noted that the single study on which the DNR had relied to suggest that this bentonite cap would be effective was not in the record. So they did not have that to look at. Even some of the DNR's own consultants actually had raised questions or concerns about the use of the bentonite, calling the DNR's conclusions wishful thinking and unproven in some cases. So clearly there are some issues about that, the use of bentonite, and so that will be the subject of a contested case hearing. And one of the things that we're still looking at is whether or not this decision by the Supreme Court means that that PolyMet will have to go back and actually reapply for a permit to mine. And if that's the case, then possibly they would have to go through a whole new process, which would include public comment and would allow for groups like the same groups that challenged the current permit, you know, to argue some of the things that they argued before that they lost this time on. I mean, one of the issues that, you know, came up was whether or not Glencore, which is now the majority owner of PolyMet, should have to be on the permit to mine. And the reason that the Supreme Court decided that was unnecessary was because at the time the permit was issued, PolyMet was not a majority owner. But now, since then, that has changed. But of course, when the court reviews an agency decision, it's based on the information that was, you know, known at the time of the decision. Because Glencore became a majority owner after the decision was made, it doesn't really count. But now if they have to go back and do a new application, then presumably Glencore would have to be added on to the permit. And, of course, you know, Glencore has a lot deeper pockets than a company like PolyMet, which really doesn't have much in the way of assets. So that would provide a little more financial protection to taxpayers in case of future cleanups might be necessary.
I know you can't really know this, but, I mean, both parties kind of claiming a victory here, but we know for sure there will be a substantial delay. Any idea on that, what that means in terms of time?
Well, I mean, I think we're probably talking a time frame involving years.
Okay.
You know, I don't think this is all going to get cleared up in a matter of months. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because right now, I mean, I'm sure PolyMet wishes they were in operation because I don't know if you, I mean, commodity prices have just skyrocketed, including the price of copper, which they probably could be making money now if they were in operation. But, of course, we know that price fluctuates. So by the time this all airs out, the price of copper could be back where it was a year ago, which was well below what they needed to be able to make money on this project. So it's... Yeah, any delay at this point is going to be problematic. The other thing is, you know, their financial outlook was based on construction prices that they had estimated now back in 2018. And, of course, we all know that construction prices have skyrocketed since. So I'm sure if you were to look at the project price tag for this mine, it's probably gone up quite a bit as well. So that also factors into the financial calculation.
Okay. Lots of moving parts.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to a really good story. The Evening Grow Speaks. They are back.
They are. And this has been, this is kind of an exciting part of the last several months around here. You know, for so many of us, I think, who spent a lot of time in northern Minnesota and have fed birds over the years, you know, back in the 1980s and 90s, you know, Evening Grow Speaks were just, you know, you kind of took them for granted. They were just so common, and we had them all the time. And I really loved having them in the yard, especially in the summertime. They were always around, it seemed like. They were either in the feeder, or they were up in the trees, and they have that very cheery kind of trill, or else they were in the garage. They always like to go in the garage, and because we have a gravel floor in there, and they'd go and eat grit. And so it seemed like we had them all the time. And then for almost 20 years, they just kind of vanished. And, you know, this wasn't just us. I mean, this was a very common experience. I mean, in fact, this was, you know, documented by various breeding bird surveys and other surveys that are being done all the time. You know, the population of evening grosbeaks across kind of the eastern two-thirds of North America really dipped dramatically, and there was a lot of concern about them because of that. And now there's some signs in the last couple years that the evening grosbeak population seem to be rebounding. So it's not really clear why they diminished so much. You know, we're thrilled here because I know we have them back. We have about a flock of a dozen evening grosbeaks that are in the yard most of the time, and they're in the feeder a lot. And they're evenly divided between males and females, so I suspect they're probably breeding somewhere right around the house. And that's great because one of the other things that was always fun about having the grosbeaks in the yard was when they would bring their young ones to the feeder and, you know, stuff them full of sunflower seeds. And so that was always fun to watch. And so we're looking forward to them bringing their fledged young here into the feeders in hopefully within a couple of weeks or so.
And what did the evening grosbeaks look like?
An evening grosbeak, well, the males are dramatically colored. They're kind of a bright yellow with also mixed in with some kind of olive color. But then they have these very bright, their head is dark except for a dramatic, like a big heavy eyebrow. Almost looks like horns on them, that's bright yellow. And then, of course, their beaks are huge. And kind of yellowish to green color. And they have, on their wings, they have black and white patterns. And the females are a little more drab, but they have their own special appeal, too. So all in all, they're bright and colorful bird, and they're about a little bit smaller than a robin, about the size of a blackbird, only they have kind of a stubbier tail.
Okay. And I suspect you're going to say no, but do you trill back to them, and what's their song?
I don't. Sometimes okay. I do respond to, but okay. that's a hard one to mimic.
All right. Well, let's move on. This one, this is not a good story here. I know for years you've been updating us on the bats, especially in the Sudan area, but there's a new study out about bats in general and the decline. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, this was a study that just came out in Conservation Biology, which is a scientific journal. And it was very bad news. I mean, they basically said that, and this isn't a huge surprise, but it was about the impact of white nose syndrome. And the estimates are that it has now killed over 90% of the three most common bat species that we have, you know, in our area and are found in eastern North America, including the northern long-eared bat, the little brown bat, and the tricolored bat. And, you know, this just sort of underscores the devastating impact that that the fungus, which causes white nose syndrome, has had since it was first introduced into North America, really only about a decade ago, which is just amazing. In 10 years, this fungus has just destroyed these bat populations. I mean, this is, you know, very close to an extinction level kind of event here. And, so it's very disturbing. And, you know, we've seen the same trend at the Sudan Mine, State Park, where the mine has been for years, was one of the largest hibernacula in Minnesota. And they had about 15 to 20,000 bats there. And now they're down to just, about 1,000 or so. So they've really seen a dramatic decline in the bats. And, I think everybody notices it now. That you're just not seeing bats like we used to. And all these bats, especially the little browns and the northern long-eared up in our region, these are the bats that were out there in the evening, feeding on your mosquitoes. And I think in my anecdotal experience, I think the mosquito population has definitely blossomed as a result of the disappearance of bats. I mean, these bats would eat hundreds of mosquitoes a night, and having them not around doing that is definitely going to be felt. It's not just, we're going to feel it, I think, in our own discomfort, but also bats are important for agriculture because they keep a lot of other pests under control. So, I mean, this is definitely a pretty tragic event. And at this point, they really still don't have a cure for this. And the only potential bright spot here is that, at this point, the bats that have survived are likely have some resistance to the disease. So if they can then become the foundation of a rebuilding population, eventually they could come back. That's the hope anyway. And the problem, of course, is that bats are tend to be long-lived, and they don't reproduce that quickly. I mean, a typical female bat will have one pup per year. So it's going to take a long time, really decades, for the bat population to rebuild to the level that we've seen in the past. And that's assuming that they don't go extinct. So it's a serious situation, there's no doubt about it.
It's Marshall Helmberger. This has been the Border News Roundup. You can read and see more at timberjay.com. Have a great weekend. We'll check in next week, Marshall.
Sounds good. Thanks, Heidi.